Last year, the United Nations Environment Programme concluded that insurance firms were not assessing the risk of climate litigation in a rigorous way, largely because they had not yet paid out for any claims. This was echoed in the Bank of England's first climate stress test earlier this year, which considered the growing prospect of climate-related payouts, in particular in lawsuits against company directors, and found that not all insurance companies had properly considered how this would affect their business. Nor are companies preparing properly for increasing claims for the impacts of extreme weather events. However, parts of the insurance industry are waking up. Some companies are now asking clients about their climate crisis reporting while negotiating liability coverage or providing more insurance capacity to those with high ESG or environmental, social and governance ratings. The Lloyd's Market Association has also published a model clause for liability policies that excludes cover for climate litigation, which insurers can use in their own documentation. Jason Reeves said these kinds of exclusions were likely to become more common. However, they would not protect companies in cases such as that of Aloha Petroleum, where the insurance policies in question dated back to the 1980s. None of the insurers or fossil fuel companies involved in the latest lawsuits responded to the Guardian's request for comment. But in its latest ESG or Environmental, Social and Governance Ratings report, AIG recognized that climate lawsuits had increased in recent years. While these kinds of actions have not resulted in material losses, AIG continues to assess the evolving norms for disclosure and expectations for corporate action around climate change, which create the potential for more climate-related litigation. Mary Sweeters said lawsuits such as those brought by Aloha Petroleum were an indicator that pressure was mounting on insurers for underwriting fossil fuel projects. Earlier this year, AIG announced it would no longer insure new coal-fired power plants, thermal coal mines, or oil sands. Mary Sweeters said industry leaders were starting to act by restricting their portfolios. But, by and large, the industry falls far short of where it needs to be.
Midstream.
In recent months, Lebanon has been negotiating to settle maritime border registration with the Zionist occupation. This negotiation, which has known difficulties and included new and illogical demands from the Israeli entity's side, is apparently nearing its end with a very good possibility that no agreement will be reached in the coming weeks. All the while, Hezbollah continues to up the ante against the Israeli occupation, warning of the possibility of military action, most likely against a naval target, and in particular against the Karish gas rig located offshore occupied Palestine in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. It is possible that in the absence of an agreement in the coming 10 days that would regulate the maritime borders between occupied Palestine and Lebanon, Hezbollah most probably will initiate the fight against the Israeli occupation, but in a new way. The Israeli occupation forces have already thickened their presence around the Karish gas rig. However, Hezbollah is the most serious fundamental threat to Israeli theft, occupation, and aggression in all of West Asia. Its military power is significantly stronger than any other resistance group Israel has faced so far, and even other armies in the region. The Israeli entity's scenario, as per its own media, for a war against Hezbollah includes hundreds of dead soldiers and severe damage to buildings and infrastructure throughout Palestinian areas occupied by Israel. This is because of Hezbollah's ability to launch thousands of rockets in a short period over many days, with great precision and firepower. The Lebanese resistance possesses approximately 50,000 short-range rockets of up to 40 kilometers, not including mortar bombs, in addition to approximately 100,000 medium and long-range rockets, dozens of which are precise and accurate. Israel has calculated that approximately 1,500 rockets will be launched each day of fighting on average from the territory of Lebanon. In addition, Hezbollah is expected to use the Radwan unit, a special ground maneuver force whose mission is to penetrate territory occupied by Israel, liberate Palestinian land from illegal Israeli settlements, and disrupt supply lines or movement of Israeli occupation forces. Hezbollah also owns a fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles and explosive drones. On top of that, Hezbollah is expected to use advanced anti-tank and anti-ship missile launch systems. In words of a Hezbollah field commander who gave an exclusive interview to Lebanese Al-Akhbar daily last week, the task for the military formations of the Islamic Resistance is to break Israel in any future battle, as this is considered one of the first steps towards its elimination. In short, as a sitting duck, Israel awaits Hezbollah's winter fire. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. It is set. In the absence of an agreement in the coming weeks that would regulate the maritime borders between Lebanon and the Zionist Israeli entity, Hezbollah will move towards what it already warned the Israeli entity against, a war to preserve Lebanon's rights in its natural resources. Israel is striving not to reach war because, as simply put by a prominent Hezbollah field commander who gave an exclusive interview to the Lebanese Daily Al-Akhbar newspaper, if Israel leads us to war, we will fight it vigorously. The field commander warned that any upcoming war will be devastating for the Zionist entity in every sense of the word, affirming that the destruction of the entity will be greater than it ever imagined. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mikhail Awad, author, political commentator, and media director of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Awad. Now, at the center of the resistance decision-making process in Lebanon, the trend was clear-cut. As one field commander, a jihadi leader in the resistance, Hezbollah, told Al-Akhbar, he said Hezbollah has entered a new phase and the mission of the resistance has evolved and its features have changed. Can you translate that on the battlefield as the tension rises between Lebanon and Israel as we approach September and the maritime border dispute is yet to be resolved between both sides?
This is the new phase that the resistance and all of the axes have entered. As Sayyid Nasrallah announced when he raised his finger and said, just as the land is ours, so is the water and all what is beneath it. Just as the skies are also ours, after the resistance declared its position of air defense weapons. What the field commander and Hezbollah stated for Al-Akhbar is just a translation of the resistance and its axes completing its preparations and all elements of transition from a defense strategy to an attack strategy. We see this in different battlefields. It is reflected practically in Lebanon. As the Islamic resistance have begun setting dates for confrontations, it has also started setting its options and directions. The upper hand in this matter is clearly for Hezbollah, when it declares that during September the maritime registration should take place as per the demands of the Lebanese government, or else there will be no gas and oil to be extracted, not only at the border with occupied Palestine, but rather throughout the entire eastern part of the Mediterranean. This means that the resistance will be the initiator of this upcoming confrontation and that the resistance's demands will be met without any deficiency. The enemy and its allies have no time for procrastination and maneuvering. If things head towards a military confrontation, then the resistance will be the one to decide 0 hour, the battlefield location and the mechanism to end this confrontation. There is no doubt that there will be a confrontation between Israel and the Islamic Resistance Hezbollah in Lebanon. If not because of maritime disputes, then it will be ignited for the many other disputes. In my personal opinion, I believe this war will take place either within weeks or within the upcoming 3 months, tops. At that point, when it happens, it will be dubbed the War of Liberating Palestine from the river to the sea.
Well, that is one dream that every true Arab is looking forward to, Dr. Awad. But another shocking statement that this anonymous field commander of Hezbollah said was that the enemy should know that the war with Hezbollah this time means the destruction of the infrastructure of the Israeli entity, which will turn the settlers' lives into real hell, unquote. What difference does it make if that actually happens when Lebanon also gets hit by the Israeli entity, and its already weakened infrastructure is all destroyed? I mean, what good can that bring with such statements, if you will?
The Zionist entity has always attempted to terrorize the Lebanese public by claiming that it possesses a massive destructive power, whether via war jets or via precision missiles, which are capable of causing grave damage. Hence, the threats made by Hezbollah field commander concerning the destruction of the Israeli entity's infrastructure is upping the ante in the face of the constant Zionist threats. This is a strategy aiming at challenging the enemy by openly saying that our destruction equals your destruction too. For instance, during this past weekend, a voice recording was leaked, most probably from within the circles of the resistance, calling the resistance fighters and the civilians alike who reside at bordering villages to occupied Palestine to be careful when they enter the liberated Palestinian villages in the Upper Galilee to protect property, cars and the security in those areas. This all means that he who decides upon 0 hour, which most probably be Hezbollah, will also control the course of the battle. When the battle begins and Hezbollah resistance fighters enter the Upper Galilee, Israel will not be able to maneuver, neither in geography nor in its ability to launch missile attacks, nor make use of its Iron Dome, nor its war jets that might not even find runways to land on when they return after the air raids. So this speech about destruction emphasized the increasing capabilities of the resistance, not only in precision missiles and armed drones, but also that its firepower is similar to that of the Israeli enemy, fully capable of causing major damage and destruction inside enemy lines. Mind you, this speech is very effective at the psychological level, knowing that the Zionist settlers are not the kind that remain steadfast during confrontations. On the contrary, they would rather flee than stay behind and fight for their entity. If this war will take place, it will do so within the heart of the Palestinian land.
Well, but there's one other thing that actually is a challenge for Hezbollah, and that is the internal political foes of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon. In the event of a war between the Lebanese resistance and the Israeli entity, do you think that Hezbollah's back, meaning the internal Lebanese arena, will be actually safe for the resistance, or we will be seeing for the first time several fronts being utilized against the Lebanese resistance with the internal Lebanese land with 1 minute, please.
In the event of a war, I believe that Hezbollah's back will be fully protected from within the Lebanese territory against all rumors. This time, the back of the resistance will be more protected than the last war in 2006. Because in 2006, the resistance faced a huge challenge internally, initiated by the cabinet and its prime minister at that time. We had back then ministers who not only covered for the massacres committed by the entity, but also provided the enemy with intel about resistance locations. This presented a grave danger to the resistance. However, today, whatever happens, even if a war breaks out, we know that the entire Lebanese regime stands behind the Lebanese resistance. Just 2 weeks ago, when the American envoy negotiating the maritime dispute, Amos Hochstein, he met with all three presidencies and they all stood behind the resistance. Which means that the actual Lebanese government, unlike what we were used to from former governments, actually stands in a different place, in support of the resistance. That was applicable due to Hezbollah's wisdom that kept reminding everyone that the resistance and its weapons stand in service of all of the Lebanese people, to retain sovereignty and to help Lebanon out of its current crisis. In short, if one morning we woke up and suddenly saw the flags of Hezbollah and Palestine raised upon the illegal Zionist settlements, it will be a magnificent scene, not only in Lebanon, but all across the Arab and Islamic world.
Well, across the whole world, that is a dream and that we wish will come true and we believe will come true. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mikhail Awad, author, political commentator and media director of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance, for joining us. Thank you for your contribution. Please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the escalating targeting of the U.S. occupation bases in Syria.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, since 2016, the U.S. occupation Al Tanf base has been located at the intersection of the Syrian-Iraqi-Jordanian border, supposedly housing Maghawir al-Thawra faction, as it was the base that was established to fight Daesh. Coincidentally or not, the presence of Daesh is still concentrated in the nearby valleys of that specific base, a presence that is activated from time to time, perhaps to bring an international justification to extend the life of the American occupation of Syrian territory. However, these attacks have intensified and expanded hours after the American assault on Deir ez-Zor last week, putting these attacks at a pace of systematic escalation separate from any possible political development in Vienna. Targeting U.S. occupation in Syria intensifies in this following report.
Washington is deliberately heating up the front against the auxiliary forces of the Syrian army after the bases of the former in Al Tanf and Al Umar were repeatedly bombed. However, the response of the Syrian Arab Army forces was also not late, as they targeted American occupation bases again amid expectations that these attacks would only escalate in the future. An escalation that appears aimed at doubling the pressure on the U.S. forces of occupation to push them to leave Syria in light of the Astana trio, Russia, Iran, and Turkey, agreeing on this end goal. Not a few hours had passed after U.S. occupation warjets attacked positions of auxiliary forces of the Syrian Arab Army in the Ayyash area in Deir ez-Zor, until these fighting groups responded by targeting the two bases of the international coalition in the Conico and Al Umar oil fields in the eastern countryside of Deir ez-Zor, which hosts American, British, and French occupation soldiers. As a result, there were casualties among the coalition forces. The U.S. military announced that an American soldier was slightly wounded, while two others were being examined for minor injuries following missile attacks in Syria at their occupation bases. On the other hand, the American forces targeted again Syrian Arab Army points in the Hawija Saqr area near Deir ez-Zor and near the city of Al Mayadin and Jabal al-Thurda, all knowingly Syrian Arab Army positions and not, as the U.S. claims to be, Iranian-backed forces. This development prompted the coalition to mobilize its forces and to request the Kurdish separatists' leadership to deploy fighters along the Euphrates River, separating its areas of U.S. control and those under the Syrian Arab Army's control in participation of attacks from the latter against the former. For its part, the U.S. Central Command acknowledged in a statement that its bases had been bombed, pointing out that several missiles fell within the vicinity of the mission support base in Conico. A short time later, rockets landed near the mission support site in the Green Village, also known as Al Umar Field. Perhaps what reinforces Washington's fears in this context is that the fighting groups that used to target the vicinity of American occupation bases with mortars and rockets without causing significant material damage to the bases themselves, this time deliberately dropped all the missiles on the two bases' headquarters with the aim of producing the greatest possible damage in them and emphasizing that the following targets will directly hit those sites in order to double the military pressure on the Americans. Perhaps the U.S. announcement of the state of alert reflects the influx of intelligence information about the possibility of a military escalation against the coalition occupation bases in both Syria and Iraq, in light of the Syrian, Russian, Turkish, Iranian consensus on the need for the Americans to leave Syria.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Mr. Tahsin Halabi, political commentator and researcher. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Halabi. And I know that you are suffering from electricity outages and several other technical issues. So I thank you for being with us despite these technical difficulties in Syria because of the sanctions. Now, let's begin at the center of the resistance in Syria against the U.S. occupation and with the escalation of the targeting of the American at 10th base. We see that these attacks not only include at 10th, but also Al-Umar and Conoco field bases as well. And they came in the wake of the American aggression on Deir ez-Zor, targeting Syrian Arab Army forces, which Biden directly ordered himself. But in light of this boiling nuclear file in Vienna, how do you assess this escalation against U.S. occupation bases inside of Syria?
I believe that after years of the presence of U.S. occupation forces at the triangle border between Syria, Iraq, and Jordan, which is known as Al-Tanf base, I believe that stressing on the continuation of this occupation as per the Hoover School of Geopolitics is simply to prevent ties between Syria, Iraq, Iran, and Jordan too. Closing the borders at that specific triangle aims at hindering military, economic, and political ties between the countries of the region. Hence, this is a strategic goal for the United States of America. But can the U.S. challenge three countries by breaching their borders and hindering them from forging ties with one another against their will? I think that is impossible, simply because the aim of the U.S. is beyond that. It aims at disintegrating Syria and Iraq. For instance, in Iraq, the U.S. is currently working on creating a separatist entity of Sunni Iraqis similar to the separatist Kurds in Syria. In the end, will this plan work? I believe the opposite will happen. All of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and the resistance factions in Syria and Iraq will increase their efforts to spoil the U.S. plans for the region. I personally believe that the U.S. will not remain inside Syria for more than 1 year. That will be possible due to the boiling security situation, not only in West Asia, but also between Russia and Ukraine, and due to the Chinese threat against U.S. hegemony in Taiwan. So there is a global wave against U.S. hegemony, and so regionally it is obvious that the axis of resistance that has the upper hand in the fight against every form of occupation inside Syria and Iraq as well.
Well, Mr. Tahsin, I definitely hear what you're saying, but according to the official U.S. statement that was released after the attack on Deir ez-Zor, it says that seven infrastructure facilities of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard were targeted in Deir ez-Zor in order to, and I quote, protect American bases from additional attacks, unquote. By claiming to target these Iranian so-called groups, the U.S. dodges the biggest question of all. What are they doing occupying Syrian land to begin with? I mean, the international community is obviously on another planet, but how much longer do you think the U.S. can play this game when 80% of the country is liberated and back in the hands of the Syrian Arab army?
I believe that the U.S. is trying to tell both Iraq and Syria that the presence of its soldiers in Syria and the war it is waging on the peoples of these two countries aims to simply remove those so-called militias. While knowing that it is these resistance groups in Syria and Iraq are the ones who initially stood against Daesh and Nusra, who came to be with European and American funding and training, these resistance factions are the ones capable of fighting and winning over the Takfiri terrorists of Daesh and Nusra, and not the US occupation whatsoever. It was evident later on, after the global war on Syria began, that it is in fact the US that is supporting these Takfiri groups instead of fighting these terrorists. This is why the US feels compelled to destroy the factions that belongs to the axis of resistance that chose to challenge the American schemes on West Asia. These resistance factions are defending their countries, their lands, from Takfiri terrorism. The Iranian, Iraqi and Syrian people know very well that it is the axis of resistance that rid them from terrorism and not the Americans whatsoever.
Well, everyone knows that the U.S. occupation does not really stop at anything. It does not stop and think of the consequences of its occupation and its aggression unless its soldiers lose their lives in these occupied territories and their movements become subject to maybe bombardments or sniping or shelling as what resistance would do against an occupation. Will the current attacks, unprecedented in their momentum, by the way, be the first step in a series of retaliations to completely eliminate American presence inside Syria? And most importantly, if it does, will it work? Will they leave Syria?
I think the U.S. is playing a game of gambling at this specific triangle border between Syria, Iraq, and Jordan. The U.S. is gambling without even having the necessary capital to support its game. It has no power to succeed in its adventure that it is currently engaging in. The U.S. occupation bases in Syria are engulfed by Syrian civilians, by the Syrian Arab Army, by the Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi, and by other resistance factions operating in and around areas illegally occupied by U.S. forces. Hence, it is these resistance factions and legitimate regional armies that will engage against U.S. occupation forces and target U.S. occupation bases. Can the U.S. challenge these factions and these armies, especially in the northeastern part of Syria? I find it hard to achieve. Its schemes have failed so far. Then how on earth will it be able to confront the wrath of those factions who own the land and who are ready to sacrifice their lives to defend it? So yes, the U.S. will face ever-increasing escalations and targeting against its soldiers, its armored vehicles and its trucks that it is using to loot Syrian oil and gas. The soldiers of the Syrian Arab Army will not choose to stand aside and watch the U.S. occupation wreak havoc in its homeland. The same goes for Iraq. The Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi have announced time and again that it stands against any form of U.S. occupation inside Iraq. Hence, this challenge will lead to an armed confrontation against the U.S. occupation forces in both Iraq and Syria, and the U.S. will have to pay a heavy price of leaving after being dealt a massive defeat from this region.
Well, it seems that the entire region of West Asia is boiling, and we might see someplace or else, not even only in Syria, but maybe also in other places, some sort of ignition and clashes that might lead to a big war in the region, but still have to see in the upcoming weeks. I want to thank you very much, Mr. Tahseen Al-Halabi, political commentator and researcher, for your contribution about talking about the intensified attacks against the U.S. occupation in Syria. And thank you. Please stay tuned, because the upcoming couple of weeks are going to be intense in West Asia, most probably between Israel and Lebanon. So stay tuned next week on the Middle East Stream.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
The Israeli regime launched on August 5th a three-day military attack on Gaza, in which it killed 49 Palestinians, including 17 children and 3 women, and left 360 injured, among them 151 children and 59 women. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Hamza Salha, writer. This article is published under the heading, The Jabalia Massacre, Heaven Embraces Five Angels. On August 6, Noor Diab woke her child, 4-year-old Jamil, to have a late lunch. He asked her to make him noodles. She fed and bathed him. Then Jamil put on his new clothes, his father Najmuddin's cologne, and his hair gel. Shortly thereafter, Jamil went to the market store with his two sisters to buy crisps and a bar of chocolate. His teenage relatives Muhammad and Hamid were in the graveyard, so he met them there while his sisters returned home. The Jabalia camp is one of the most densely populated areas in the blockaded strip. Because there are no parks in their neighborhood, the children living there always go to the graveyard to play and have fun. Jamil Muhammad Hamid Jamil Ihab Najm, 13, and their friend Nazmi Abu Karash, 13, were sitting near their grandfather's grave in front of their houses. That's when the Zionist regime targeted them, although there were not any fighters there, according to eyewitnesses. Noor said, "Suddenly I heard a massive blast. My two other daughters and I escaped to the western room to protect ourselves. Pedestrians started shouting that the bombardment was in the graveyard. Noor's brother-in-law's wife was screaming, 'Jamil has been killed. Jamil has been killed.' I didn't believe her as I hadn't known he was in the graveyard," Noor said later while holding back her tears. "When I learned Jamil was murdered, I fainted. When I woke up, I could not receive any mourners." Because Jamil's body was shattered into pieces like his three relatives' bodies, Noor could not hug him before burying him. The raids which targeted the Jabalia graveyard killed 5 children. 4 of them are cousins, and 1 is their neighbor. "I don't think the Israeli regime will be held accountable since it has never been held accountable before," the grieving mother added. Ismail Abu Mahdi, 36, was standing by the Western Cemetery gate at the moment of the bombardment. Ismail said, "I heard a massive explosion in the graveyard. I was confused about whether to enter or run away until I heard a scream, 'My son, my son.' He directly rushed in and saw children's bodies scattered everywhere and their blood covered 3 graves, one of them their grandfather's." Ismail said, "Then a father of a martyr carried the remains of his son and entered his house, hoping that his son was alive. Another father carried the remains of his son to the ambulance." The Zionist regime launched on August 5th a three-day military attack on Gaza in which it killed 49 Palestinians, including 17 children and 3 women, and left 360 injured, among them 151 children and 59 women. "I could not recognize my son's face. I recognized him by his T-shirt," Ihab Najm, 42, said with tears in his eyes and a strained voice. His son Ismail, 13, used to play with his 4-year-old cousin Jamil Najmuddin, who was very attached to him and followed him to his grandfather's grave. Ihab said, "Like my other children, Jamil was so afraid of the Israeli regime bombing. Jamil liked to play football, excelled in his school, and his dream was to be a doctor. Ihab Najm, in shock, said, "I didn't allow Jamil to visit his friend next door due to the Israeli regime bombing. During the bombing, my son was sitting on his grandfather's grave, and I never expected the graveyard to be bombed." On the day of the massacre, 3 hours before he was killed, Muhammad Najm, 16, had taken part in a funeral of 7 Palestinians, including 4 children killed, on August 6th in front of Imad Aghil Mosque in Jabalia. One of the killed children was Muhammad Najm, 16, whose friend Khaled, 16, was next to his grave. "I have known him for 8 years. We studied together in the third grade. We used to go to school together every day and go to the Gaza Sea 3 times a week, said Khaled Yaghi, crying. He visited his friend's grave almost daily. Khaled said, "Muhammad and Hamid Najm, who were killed, were my friends. We used to hang out together every day. Muhammad was a pure child and excelled in his studies. His dream was to be an engineer." Muhammad's cousin, Hamid Najm, was their friend in the same school and class. He was an excellent student and his dream was to be a doctor. Noor Diab is still shocked and cannot cope with her child's killing. "I'm dying every second when I see my son's pictures everywhere. Today I saw his kindergarten bus, which he will never ride again," she said, adding, "Jamil's sisters came home, but he never will."
Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
If the world were black and white, Iran's present administration would be white, judging by what 3 out of 4 experts told me. It may have not seemed like it, but President Raisi's economic surgery has begun to yield results, they say. He has taken action regardless of appearances and has taken foreign policy forth regardless of the JCPOA and FATF.
Former President Rouhani is being blamed for pinning everything to the JCPOA and so pinning down the country and its economy. Now, why would it have been such a bad thing, using anything as leverage to get Iran's rulership to agree to signing the JCPOA and joining the FATF? That's the Global Financial Action Task Force to counter money laundering and terrorism. To hear why, against the vision of Raisi's successes in honor of Government Week, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today.
The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or Iran nuclear deal, was the one way to get the world to trust this country's nuclear program is peaceful and for scientific use. This would guarantee security and sanction lifting to allow our foreign trade to flow. But in securing trade and relations with the West, while scrapping sanctions, it would leave out fellow Muslim neighbors, fellow Asians, and fellow members in the U.S. sanctions club. We've got economists and economic experts on the show today to keep views as factual as possible. They all joined us in Press TV studios. Let's hear Mr. Husseini as he looks at Iran's situation from an oil and energy-related perspective against the country's overall foreign policy.
The error of the Rouhani administration was to define the JCPOA as a strategic action. After the JCPOA was signed and the international stage became available again, they approached Western countries and didn't use the opportunity to make measures that would render sanctions ineffective. Instead, it went into business with Western companies like Total and others, which left Iran after the sanctions were reimposed. Now Mr. Raisi can employ JCPOA as a tactic, focusing more on business opportunities with Eastern Bloc countries like China, Russia, and in general, Asian countries. They can strengthen their relations and reinforce partnerships. I'm not saying they should only deal with Asian companies. Western ones can be present as well. But our strategy should be towards this end, to strengthen our relations with countries that are in the bloc against the United States.
The West does have its own United States and European Union, so why should we have a divided Muslim Middle East to win their favor? In focusing too much on the JCPOA, Iran was securing Western ties at the risk of alienating more eager customers and brother nations.
We even ruined our relationship with China for no reason, because Mr. Rouhani thought that in order to attract Europe, we should sabotage our relations with China, and they would appreciate it enough to invest in Iran, like expelling Chinese partners from oil projects, the cold mannerism towards the Chinese president during their trip in 2015, refusing the $50 billion investment offered by the Chinese to Iran, and other actions like that resulted in the Chinese side realizing the lack of interest. Because of this, later on, when the sanctions were implemented in his second term, China would not cooperate with us like in the first term. If you pay close attention to the OPEC report within 2011 and the signing of the JCPOA, we had exported 1 billion barrels of crude oil despite the maximum pressure sanctions against Iran. Because China was cooperating with us, but after the U.S. pulled out of the JCPOA and imposition of sanctions, China did not cooperate with us.
Another downside was, when Trump's U.S. pulled out of the deal in 2018, Iran was left with reversed and partly paralyzed nuclear facilities, more sanctions than before the deal, and fewer European trade partners. Raisi seems to have made that a lesson, seeing as his new government followed the policy of looking to the east and did not slow down the country with the JCPOA.
In the real sense of the word, the 13th administration has not delayed its economic plans in anticipation of the JCPOA. They have been present in the negotiations and have followed JCPOA developments closely. I think a significant progress for the Iranian economy in the past year is that it will have more options on the board if the JCPOA negotiations are successful. If the JCPOA comes into effect and becomes operational, in addition to the JCPOA and an increase in trade with European partners and even Americans, there's BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation, Russia, China, and India. That's what I mean by saying Iran will have more options on the board.
Joining regional economic pacts such as Shanghai and Eurasia and the 25-year cooperation document between Iran and China, while JCPOA sanction-lifting Vienna talks have not yet concluded, are examples of this will. As are the Gazprom contract with Russia or BRICS and the 20-year partnership with Venezuela. It is long-term understandings Iran has been rooting for, although the 25-year agreement with China was signed in Tehran on March the 27th, 2021. That's during the former administration's term. Except it was signed after the U.S. binned the nuclear deal and Iran appeared desperate for friends. I give you Mr. Hashemzadeh for an expert's view.
The first contract that the 13th administration implemented on the international stage was the natural gas swap agreement with Turkmenistan. What this resulted in was the reduction of our pressure drop numbers to nearly zero, and we effectively had zero pressure drops in the northern provinces of the country. This event was significant as the first agreement by Mr. Raisi's administration since the lack of natural gas and even electricity in 2020 had caused security problems for the country.
In the field of crude oil trade, the current administration is pursuing oil marketing strategies. It means increasing the crude oil export volume without sacrificing safety. For example, one of the strategies of oil marketing is by demand purchase. This strategy can be realized by investing in foreign oil refineries. In this administration, Iran attempted to become an investor in Latin American refineries. In Venezuela, Iran has officially invested in two refineries, El Palito and Paraguana. By the virtue of becoming an investor in the refineries, a corridor for crude oil export to Venezuela was established for Iran. We now export roughly 200,000 barrels of crude oil and natural gases to Venezuela every day.
Regarding U.S. sanctions, they had a negative impact on Iran in previous times because Iran's relations with neighboring countries were not favorable, according to Javad Karimi Qoddousi. In other words, as far as you get, you'll always need your family base. Whereas we'd put all our eggs in someone else's basket, leaving ourselves without any other bargaining chips. Qoddousi is a member of the Parliamentary National Security and Foreign Policy Committee here.
International agreements between Iran and anyone else would be a win-win situation. Anyone doing business with us will have struck gold, because this country is located on the crossroads between north-south and east-west countries, except they'd have to face U.S. secondary sanctions for dealing with us. However, oil and gas don't seem to be such an issue with sanctions anymore.
Because with global shortages and rising prices, governments worldwide look to secure their oil supplies in the face of sanctions. In fact, according to Ehsan Khandouzi, Minister of Economy, due to the increase in oil exports and our new budget's currency conversion rate, we saw a 580% increase in the Treasury's income from the export of oil and condensate in the first 4 months of this Iranian calendar year. That's to say, Iran has managed to sell considerably and receive revenues in spite of sanctions.
In general, the plans implemented by this administration in the previous year were designed to account for a failure to implement the JCPOA again. As I said, the events in 2021 forced our people to face the difficulties of being sanctioned, gas shortages, power outages, and extreme cases of gasoline disequilibrium in the summer, subsidized currency exchange rates which could not be allocated because of budget shortages, and even foreign currency reserve deficit. All of these should have naturally driven us to the negotiating table, forcing us to compromise. This administration was able to implement strategies that allowed it to deal with these issues without signing a single FATF agreement or the JCPOA. It was even said that we wouldn't get vaccines if we don't sign the FATF deal.
The country needs its oil money to rebuild its economy, which is facing over 50% inflation, which in turn is driving product and utility costs up. Good thing everyone wants a piece of Iran's oil, especially as Iran can easily compete with its prices, given the Brent benchmark has increased from $76 per barrel just over a year ago to $104 per barrel.
Positive or negative performance is not absolute. We can't see an administration as totally negative and another one as absolutely positive. We always compare different administrations and form an opinion in comparison. In such a comparison, and based on the accumulation of economic developments that we have witnessed, the 13th administration is performing its activities by implementing policies that are more aligned with Iran's economic conditions. And I believe it will enjoy better results when compared to the 11th and 12th administrations.
In fact, former administrations have been so bent on securing relations with the West that the rest of the world became a blind spot to them, perhaps partly because of the preoccupation drawing up the complicated agreement the JCPOA caused, until it finally became operational, which left Iran with enormous Western delegations to host and enter investment talks with. Before that nuclear agreement was signed, so many measures were kept hostage to get it signed, and after it was signed, the FATF was used in the same vein.
When we analyzed the reports from the first quarter of 1401, in comparison with the same period last year when the 12th administration was in office, we can see a 22% increase in non-oil exports. Logically, you can't ascribe this increase to an increase in foreign currency exchange rates or similar reasons. That's because exchange rates increased fourfold or fivefold in the period between 2018 and 2020. But we didn't have an increase in non-oil exports proportionate to the increase in exchange rates. Perhaps we can say the most significant factor for this increase in non-oil exports is the shift in the administration's strategy and its stance on its relationship with neighboring countries. Currently, more than 50% of our economic exchanges and trades are in partnership with our 15 neighboring countries.
I can understand lesser issues being used to get the JCPOA signed and made to work by joining the FATF. But the deal was even tied to health issues. Experts today say corona vaccines were not being imported or released by Rouhani's men in office under the pretext sanctions would not allow imports. And so the JCPOA would have to be signed and FATF joined for vaccines to be sold to us. Listening to Ain Ullahi, the health minister, he said, vaccines were used as a political tool so that people were pressured to accept some measures, such as the FATF, Global Financial Action Task Force, or the JCPOA and the like. When we started the new government, we did not have any vaccines in the first week. You all know about it, but vaccines entered the country very quickly. Time for a short break. We'll be back in no time.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Coming up, but first a quick media review to see what other outlets have to say.
Mer News quotes the oil minister. Hormozgan to turn into refining hub of Iran. Javad Orji, the minister, said numerous projects have been defined in the southern province of Hormozgan to turn it into a refining hub within years. Speaking to reporters on the sidelines of a virtual ceremony to launch a major gas project in Kish Island, Orji said that the projects will need up to $25 billion of investment. He also said that numerous upstream and downstream projects will be launched during Government Week, which begins August the 24th. The official also underlined the inauguration of the gas transmission pipeline in Kish Island, adding an annual revenue of $400 million will be one of the achievements of the project, besides protecting the region's environment and generation of jobs. We've got a piece from Blockworks. It reads, Iran Inc.'s first import order paid with crypto. Iran will commonly use crypto to settle import orders by the end of next month, tweeted the head of Iran's trade promotion organization. Iran is reportedly moving to directly facilitate imports with crypto, which could allow the nation to bypass hard-hitting sanctions imposed by the U.S. Local news outlet Tasnim reported that the Islamic Republic filed its first crypto-based order worth $10 million, but didn't specify which digital asset was used for the transaction or what was imported. Alireza Peymanpar, head of the country's trade promotion organization TPO, appeared to confirm the order in a tweet and said it could be the first of many. The TPO, which is tied to the nation's Ministry of Commerce, promotes Iran's non-oil exports. Tehran Times, a source I often visit, reads, transit of goods via Iran rises 25% in 5 months on year. Transit of commodities through Iran increased 25% in the first 5 months of the current Iranian calendar year, which means March the 21st to August the 22nd, as compared to the same period of time in the past year, the head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Customs Administration, Erika, announced. After 7 years of reduction in the transit of goods from the country, the growth path of transit resumed in the past Iranian calendar year 1400, which ended on March the 20th. And with the passage of 12.65 million tons of goods through Iran, a growth of 68% was achieved. The spokesman of Erika had previously noted, "The 68% growth in transit last year and the 39% rise in the first 2 months of this year promised to reach 15 million tons of goods passing through Iran in the current year, which has been unprecedented in the entire history of the country." In mentioning Raisi's achievements, our economists point to his economic surgery and scrapping the preferential rate of the dollar. That would be 42,000 riyals to the dollar, which is about a seventh of the market rate.
One of the biggest challenges that the 13th administration had was allocating preferential exchange rates to basic commodities. It is well known that the allocation of preferential exchange rates to imports came with its own range of issues and corruption. There was the issue of reverse smuggling, the depletion of resources, and the fact that the consumer was not effectively benefited from this money. As a result, Raisi administration decided to change its course. In a way, the subsidies were shifted from the start of the supply chain to the last link.
Scrapping the preferential rate of the dollar, if nothing else, was a bold move which the average government wouldn't dare attempt in its first year in office.
Under any circumstances, removing the 4,200 toman dollar exchange rate would impact the popularity of an administration. It was natural, and when the administration started the process, it was aware that this act can have a negative impact on its popularity. But once the experts concluded that this was a necessary course of action, and allocating the 4,200 toman exchange rates would do more harm than good to the economy in long term, it made the decisive choice to start following this line of policy. This is an unprecedented event if you look through Iran's political history. No government would implement a fundamental and necessary plan that would damage its popularity.
Ayatollah Raisi took credit as he said that nothing special had happened to increase the import of vaccines or our country's membership in the Shanghai Organization, except for the fact that our neighboring and friendly countries saw that we no longer focus only on the West, and that having interaction with neighbors and countries in the region have become a priority of Iran's foreign policy. Now, in foreign transaction, Iran's focus is on exports outdoing imports. Exports being a natural outcome of industry, the strengthening of which would contribute to a resistance economy, which was talked about a lot during the former administration. I asked what exactly the Raisi administration is doing to get dormant businesses up and running, as that is a priority with him, as the solution to economic problems lies in production in the agricultural and industrial sectors, because import will undermine independence, as he put it. Now, we are horribly short on water resources, and so we've gone for trans-territorial cultivation. Since about 85% of the country's fresh water is used in agriculture, this project can be both a shortcut for agricultural development and the restoration of the country's water resources. For example,
agricultural projects abroad have always been relevant. Perhaps the lack of economic diplomatic efforts have halted that front. Venezuela has agreed to provide 1 million hectares of agricultural land for Iran's overseas cultivation projects to secure food. But the point is that strategic commodities create food security. These strategic commodities are obvious. For example, we are experiencing shortages when it comes to livestock, while we could increase the production of such commodities to the point of self-sufficiency.
Ebrahim Raisi urged banks to direct banking facilities to the production sector, saying, "Whenever we have an increase in liquidity and these costs do not go to production, we have to worry about its harms, including its inflationary consequences." 211 idle industrial units have been revived in the country's industrial parks and zones in 100 days since the beginning of the current Iranian calendar year, beginning March the 21st.
When we talk about reviving different sectors, we should remember that an economy is like a package and cannot be limited to a single sector. Imagine that production units are once again back in circulation through state accommodations. If the commodities that are produced don't enter the market, this cycle of production will face a downfall. This is a problem we have faced throughout the previous decades, and it's why a